Gaming on the Frontier.
This is Bruce.
This is Trav.
This is Jonathan.
And this is Carrie again.
Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier, your podcast of finding out we were wrong, but there was reasons.
We're all adults enough here to realize once in a while that we can be wrong.
I don't know about you. I'm never wrong.
I'm rarely wrong.
Jonathan, you just said you want to see the whole world burn, so just...
And am I wrong? Is that a wrong statement?
Well...
Did he say which world he wants to see burn?
Mm-hmm. We're getting back to the old joke that says, you know, define the universe, give three examples. Which actually works when you think about video games. But, you know, that's not our topic tonight. Tonight... Welcome to Gaming on the Frontier. Our topic tonight is computer RPGs and tabletop RPGs. How are they the same? How are they different? We did an earlier episode way back. And for once, I'm not going to tell you to go back and listen to it because the title of it was Why Are Video Games Make Lousy RPGs? What I'm saying now is that I think maybe 10 years later, we should review this and maybe that statement is no longer true.
I do think, my dear friend, with the recent success of the mind-blowingly wonderful Baldur's Gate 3, that, yeah, we need to reassess this.
That's one of the games I have not played yet because I've been too busy playing other games.
Neither. It's on my Steam wish list. It's just sitting there mocking.
Yeah.
I've been playing real life keeps distracting me, and it's like, stop that.
Yeah, I live vicariously through others in both the roommate and mine and Carrie's mutual gamer and my coworker Joel have all played it, and just, yeah. So I think with that leading the charge, we do need to look again at the subject that we did previously. So, yes.
Right. So, what I'm going to do here is that, you know, is following our normal topical method of looking at things. We're going to define a few terms so that, you know what we mean when we talk about them. And then we're going to go through a number of topics having to do with computer RPGs and tabletop RPGs. And we're going to talk about the pros and the cons of each of them, not so much against each other, but how they might differ one to the other. So what we're saying is we're not trying to be critical here. You know, there are some things that computer RPGs do much better, and there's some things that tabletop RPGs continue to excel at. Okay, but a lot of the other things that we used to think was a real problem, okay, may no longer be true, and our listener can make that decision. You know, now we have much more naturalistic. Now when you click on somebody, you know, you get decision trees, you get, you know, dialogue presented to you, and one of the nice things about the dialogue is the fact is that it can enforce your character, you know, the choices you made in character creation. It can give you dialogue that's appropriate to your character. So if you made someone who's really nasty, you know, chaotic evil type of character, all your dialogue options are going to be like, you know, come over here or I'll rip your throat out, versus the lawful good character who would be like, I am the kindest person you ever met. Sit down, let's have some tea and discuss what it is we want to do. You know, it's completely different dialogues because it knows,
yeah,
the decisions you made, and it works in that. Computer games now, all that stuff that goes into the background of your character is all being handled in milliseconds, you know, by these powerful dialogue engines and such to give you the options that the designers have decided, okay? So you still don't have infinite options, even within what would be normally you'd consider a scene would have. They don't have infinite money and they don't have infinite, so they basically give you the options they think will be, A, helpful to you or things that you may like, you know, and it may be bad for your character, you know, cause a negative reaction that might cause a combat that could get your character killed, end of game. But it's an option that makes sense for your character, so we can't fault them for that. Okay, but a lot of times there's no take backs in a lot of these cases. You can't suddenly go, I was just kidding. Let me make a persuasion check. Usually that option is not available in a computer RPG.
No.
However, when you go to the tabletop RPGs, Trav, what do you get to do that you really can't do so much inside of a computer RPG?
Well, goal resolution, it's the GM that has all that. They are the one setting up the world for you. The levels of realism, it's all on the GM to perform the exposition to the players to, okay, this is what can go on, this is what's happening, and hopefully through that exposition I've given you, at least a few options. The human mind being far more flexible than a written computer program, as of now, anyways. The GM, as I said, he can lay out, what's the word I'm looking for here? I guess parameters of what he wishes to expose to the players and the characters' sensorium.
Wow, that was complicated, yeah. So maybe add to that, a GM can pivot. You know, he's going to provide, the same options that you get in a computer game as the default options, as say, this is the most likely things that you're going to be perceiving in this situation. But if a player decides to get creative, the GM can go with it, which you're not going to get in a computer RPG.
My tabletop,
because it's true.
My tabletop does not have dialogue trees.
Sometimes, well, see, that's the downside. Is the fact is that a lot of it, again, it's up to the in a tabletop, it's up to the player to enforce character. So a lot of times a player may not be playing according to their character in regards to dialogue.
Yeah.
So it's they become very reactive instead of proactive. It was one of the nice things about dialogue trees is that they're essentially more proactive about following the character that you've created and maybe the classes. Yeah. If you're playing a really dumb person, supposedly you get a one intelligence and Fallout,
you get all sorts
get
of fun
lines to say. The lines are like, "Duh, sky is big."
Me break it. Yeah.
You pretty. And when you're saying that to like a guy in power armor, it's pretty funny. Then you find out that the person with power armor is actually female and you're male, and all of a sudden something, could happen. But that's that's the creativity of someone has to write that opportunity, so in a lot of games, doesn't have it, but it's great when it's there. It's great when you get a lot of really creative things because there's a lot of videos on YouTube where they said, hey, you go into, the big floating dirigible of in Fallout 4 with the with all the Brotherhood of Steel, okay, there you usually are going to go there, with this companion or by yourself because they hate synths. But what if you do bring, this the one synth that you have along? Most people aren't going to do it. But since you had the option of doing it, they actually wrote dialogue for it. And some things that can happen. So it's a cool thing, you know, when they do that. Now, what they can handle is if you wanted to grab somebody in a tabletop RPG, anybody could be could be a companion, any NPC, you know, and you could have grabbed that person and take them with you, but the game doesn't understand now what to do with that person. So it would probably pretty much ignore that person, you know, unless whoever, you know, gave you that option, because there are people who mod games, actually put in dialogue that lets you do stuff.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to, you know, how what's easy to do in a tabletop RPG many times is very hard to do inside of a computer, but also vice versa. Things that are really hard to do, easy to do in computers, you know, is really hard to do, it's very hard to do it fast in a tabletop.
I can spend months writing the perfect dialogue tree for Fallout, but put me at the table and I might not be able to come up with such witty banter quickly in response to my player.
And players, because GMs vary very much, you know, when you go to another GM doing the same scenario or whatever, you might have a completely different experience because there's no uniformity except what is written down, you know, in the game description, the adventure description. But you'd have that same happen if you went from one AAA game to another AAA game, basically another company. You know, your experience is going to vary depending upon what, you know, where they put their emphasis, where they put their creative energies in the computer RPG. So, you know.
I would point out an example we've been using all night is Fallout. Fallout 3 versus Fallout New Vegas, both using almost the exact same engine, both set in the Fallout universe, but made by two different companies. Both released by Bethesda, but made by two different companies. And there are very obvious differences between the two. Some people like aspects of 3 more than New Vegas. Some people like aspects of New Vegas. I mean, I have my opinions of both of them as well. Yeah. So.
Okay. So, anyways, you know, like I said, you can have really, really complex goals, you know, in a computer RPG that's been enforced by its development. Having very complex goals in a tabletop generally is a problem because then you've got, you know, because the GM has to adjudicate everything and the players have to basically figure out a lot of times what those goals really are. But on the other hand, the players can give themselves goals that you couldn't get, which was not an option. You know, well, it is sometimes an option inside these AAA games if they're kind of open worldish, you know.
Like open sandbox games.
But, if you remember my the episode we did where I said playing Fallout 3 as a Meller. Remember that episode? A Meller, for those of you who are not familiar with Tri-Tac games, a Meller is one of the big baddies inside the Fringeworthy game. It is essentially a shape-shifting monster. Okay, it's you know the epitome of evil. You know, it wants to destroy the world around it, but it's smart. So as a result, it sometimes will make decisions that are not obviously evil, but the end result will be evil. So
they play the long game very
exactly.
Very
so
well.
What I said was, is that okay? I'm playing Fallout. No, the way you're supposed to be this guy from a vault, and he basically is escaping the vault in order to find his father. He's a young guy, okay, and he leaves going out, doesn't know anything about the world, right? I said, what happens if when he leaves the vault, he gets killed and replaced by a Meller who absorbs all of his memories and therefore can basically, he's the same person, you know, except he's now a Meller. Now the whole everything that's happened before is basically no longer true. And you're now...
You're saying he wants to watch the world burn?
Yes, he definitely does, okay? So so when he goes, so at one point in the game, you go to a town where they've got a big nuclear bomb in the center of it, and only a real terrible person is going to go in there and detonate that bomb, because someone's willing to give him money and a really nice apartment to stay in.
What is the Miller?
But the Miller is like, well, sure. This is right inside my wheelhouse. It makes perfect sense for a Miller to do it. So I'm just saying, by the player playing this subtext in their head, they can basically justify their actions in a way that makes the game make a lot more sense if you go that particular route in those particular decisions. So, and I had a lot of fun doing that. I actually did, and I tried to make the character, more and more like a Meller as time went on, and it was a lot of fun to do. But believe me, the designers of that game had never intended someone to be a Meller. They said, okay, you can be a bad, terrible person, all right, and we will allow you to do that. We will even give you dialogue to support that, okay, which is great in Bethesda's favor, okay, but not a shape-shifting monster from beyond the universe. Okay, that's something that the player is actually enforcing on the game, but I could do it. So, I could actually... use that meta knowledge and actually make decisions in the game, and it made sense. So, if you were playing something like a lot of games, could you do that? Other computer games, especially earlier computer games, I'm not sure you could. But of course, it's something you could always do in a tabletop, because you could just simply say, hey, GM, this is what I'm doing. And the GM's like, well, that's pretty wacky, but I don't see any reason to not let you do it, as long as you follow the same rules as everybody else as far as gaining abilities and things like that. And he says, yeah, cool. So so that's, that's some of the things that you could do as far as goal resolution that are, that are the same now possible in both the CRPGs and also in tabletop, and how sometimes they still are different. So, okay. So, Carrie, talk about testing.
I mean, testing is one of those things. We already touched on it when we were talking about, releasing games for beta testing and using essentially the players as your debuggers / idea makers. And generally speaking, with computer RPGs, even barring the beta releases for player input, etc., there's still a vast amount of testing that must happen beforehand, because that is the nature of the beast of computers. You've got to test things, debug it if it has a screw up, like a certain horse floating in the sky, things like that. So you always have to do a great deal of that, and usually before initial release, at least the majority of it. And then the assumption is that any of the beta releases is basically so they can put the spit shine and polish on it to get the last little, rough spots out of the edges and what have you. And so that leaves you with a very well-tested product, theoretically. Okay. Again, we're talking about the best, not the worst. So in the best products, you're going to have a well-tested product that is released into the wild and is never going to be flawless, but it's going to be way better than average. Whereas with, the con for that is that the game is so well-tested that it doesn't leave a lot of room for revamping things that turned out to be not the greatest idea. And maybe we should have redone a mechanic on that or rejiggered something over here. But, we've gone too far into the process. So now you're you're not stuck. I'm not going to entirely describe it like that. But that is the product that's put out. And maybe on, a patch later on, or, the next release, the next iteration of the game, Fallout 5, Fallout 6. Whichever one is next, gets that idea implemented, but it can't be as easily added mid-game release or just prior to release, you know, along the lines when it's further along the process. Early on, yes, it's easy to add things. Later on, not so much.
You go to the powers that be and say, hey, I got this really great idea we could do in the game. And the guys say, how much testing is it going to take? And he says, oh, you know, it shouldn't take more than 2 or 3 weeks to test it fully after we introduce it. He says, sorry, our goals are, you know, our deadline is coming up in 1 week. We can't do it. You know, it could be the greatest thing since sliced cheese, and they're going to look at you and say, ain't happening.
Yep, not this time, not now.
Yeah.
We'll put a pin in it for the future.
And if the game is especially well-designed today, maybe there will be an option in the future to be able to bring that in, you know, in a DLC or anything else, you know, but initially, you know, if it doesn't fall within their project plan, even if it's the greatest idea in the world, you're not going to be able to do it because there's too much at risk if you're wrong. And even if you're right, it just simply doesn't fit.
Right, right. Absolutely.
All right, so, what happens if you, with testing in tabletop RPGs?
Well, that's the kind of fun part is, I mean, because having done it myself, both in a game I've run with my homebrew campaign and Trav being so wonderful, letting me kind of play test a few of my homebrew world races and so forth, is it literally, you can be in the dead middle of a game. You can be, you know, 10th level and the plot line's already gone a long ways into this direction. And suddenly we realize, all of us as players or one of us, that we're missing X, Y, or Z ability that should be there for our players, whether it's astronavigation, you know, when we're starting out with a full fantasy, you know, like proper high fantasy setting, but then we get a spaceship of some sort and we're like, well, okay, how do our players handle this? It's gone so far, you know, from the where we started. So it's really easy for a DM or GM to throw new ideas out there for everybody to just try and go, okay, from now on, when we do this, we're going to do this. Let's try it. Go! The problem from that is that the downside is that, well, we are literally trying out a new mechanic, and it could fail miserably, or it could have hidden, you know, excessive power to it and needs to be rolled back a little. those couple feats, Trav,
The
sages and the applied scholastics and that sciatic class. Yeah. So it's very much where it's like, oh, didn't see how that was going to work out when we first saw this idea. So then we ran with it. And now what do we do? Now we have to either backpedal or just continue to run with it and watch things get way out of hand.
Yeah, because with GMing like that, no, it's where, okay, we've done it into the campaign. We're now 3-4 sessions in. This is what it is. A GM is like, if I sit there and all of a sudden say, okay, we need to nerf this now. GMs are not perfect. We will still, okay, oh crap, we didn't figure that this permutation of adding this new rule could get this far off base. And you have that thing, okay, we can either just nerf it now, which you end up with sometimes a very angry player because they wanted this, and it's like, okay, so you just basically nerf my character, or you just got to let it run its course and just see how out of whack the campaign gets. And just,
I mean, the upside to that is when you let it see how far out of whack it can get, the next iteration around, the next campaign, whatever, we can go, okay, that rule, no more.
does not work with this concept.
This does not work. Does not compute.
We can use this rule, but only in these situations. Yeah.
Correct. And so it's possible, again, with a good table of players and a good GM and, you know, intelligent adult human beings to, pull this stuff off in the middle of a campaign, but at the same time, it's fraught with the danger of, you know, the Nova problem that comes up a lot with, like, psionics is mentioned a lot as the Nova problem. Suddenly you have a character who can, you know, blow a planet in half with one blow, with one hit, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, oh, if we're all Superman, then what do we have to fight? Then what do we fight against? Oh, now we got a, you know, it'll be the arms race of, you know, heroes and villains. And at some point, yeah, the brakes need to be put on that. But
yeah,
that's an advantage and a disadvantage at the same and one and the same time of tabletop RPGs, is that they are so sandboxy that you can throw new stuff in, but then there are very much unintended consequences. Where with a computer game, you can't throw those things in and have possible good outcomes, but you prevent the negative outcomes of throwing out new ideas like that.
So tabletop RPGs tend to have limited testing of the things they're already including, not to mention anything new that you might bring in. So as an example of something that was positive, in Savage Worlds, there's no skill. There's no way of automatically detecting that somebody is lying. Someone's trying, you know, without basically doing a persuasion versus perception check. Okay, you know, so, but if someone literally just tells a lie, you know, in a lot of other games, you have an insight check or you have something else. And I went online and I was like looking and say, how do I deal with this? And everybody was like saying, oh yeah, just, you know, use your notice, which is their perception based skill. And I'm like going, I don't want to do that because it's already overwhelmingly powerful. I mean, notice, you know, allows you to see hidden things. Notice allows you to detect everything in your environment. Notice, you know, see the important details. Okay, so it's already a pretty uber skill to begin with. You know, it's much like the fighting skill. You know, those two are the most important skills in the game. Everyone always pumps all their, you know, their points into it. I said, I don't want to give something else. And I said, what I really need is I need the ability to determine whether or not someone is lying, whether something is the truth. And I said, what we need is the ability to interrogate somebody, you know, in a way that, you know, that if you make a good roll, that you know that you got the answers that you know, the good answers, or you know that they were lying to you. Okay. Problem is that skill didn't exist. So I said, I'm adding it into the game. And I told my players, this is okay. Everybody has this skill. You have it at the lowest possible level, but you do have it. So now, if you want to tell whether someone's lying or not, use it. You know, you can pump this up to higher levels as you gain experience, or you can just count on the fact that, you know, they're just a really bad liar, and you're going to be able to figure it out. Everyone liked that solution. It solved the problem. And it didn't mean that I didn't continue to, deify these two skills. You know, I gave them another skill that wasn't going to be used all the time, you know, and that theoretically didn't have to be used, because like a lot of lawyers say, I don't want to know whether my client's guilty or not guilty. All I care about is doing my job, presenting their case, you know, as effectively as possible. And knowing whether they're guilty and not guilty actually makes it harder for me to do my job. So, you know, it's, and like I said, everyone loved that, and we've been doing it ever since. And now, of course, we just added it for new characters so they can start off that way with that skill and be able to enhance it at a much lower level. So it worked. It worked out fine. So, and you could do that so very easily at a tabletop. Okay, and of course, like I said, as you've already mentioned, Carrie, you can't do that, you know, in a computer RPG, because it's going to touch on so many things. You know, if all of a sudden you could tell if everybody was lying, you know, it would be an issue. You know, so unless of course they have a skill in the game which is detect lying. So yeah,
fair enough.
All right, so moving on from testing, which is to the visuals. All right.
My favorite part as an artist. My favorite.
Well, then talk about it.
I mean, I can honestly say, being part of both gaming environments, again, the game that I've put the most, the computer RPG that I put the most time in currently is Monster Hunter. So that's why I use it as my example. When I get to playing Baldur's Gate 3, I'll use that too. But really, honestly, it's kind of like Las Vegas, where they make the, you know, casino interiors, no clocks, and they make the very fancy, busy ceilings and carpets to keep you focused down the middle and all the blinking lights and so forth. Literally, those detailed, rich environments that are created and the background music and everything else, it is so easy to just get lost running around the forest, gathering mushrooms and plants and rocks and things, just because of how beautiful the visuals are. And it, like, literally the flowing water in some of the scenes is delightful. When it rains, the sound of the rain, you know, coming out of the speaker and the headphones is amazing. And that's something that you, unless you have like the ultimate $1 million tabletop gaming room with, you know, the full surround sound, you know, sound bars and speakers and things, and you've got like the really cool queued up music and visuals and things, it's really something that is, you have to do it all in your head. Theater of the mind is those sounds and visuals of the environment you're in. But at the same time, there is very much the part where a good GM, a really good GM, can describe the scene well enough that you can fill in the blanks with your experiences in the real world. Like, we all know what, you know, a singing bird sounds like. Every one of us might hear a different bird in our head, but if Trav is describing, you know, there's beautiful bird song out in the woods in the forest as you walk into the dappled sunlight of the, you know, elven glade, pretty much all of us who play have either A, seen some visuals or experienced some real life visuals that match those words. So it's really, when it comes to computer games versus tabletop RPGs, the computer games, their goal is to draw and create and present to you a visual version of what you're describing. And tabletop RPGs, it's the GM's goal to use the language well enough to describe the scene well enough that, just like reading a good book, your brain fills in the rest of the details and you don't actually need to spend millions of dollars on a computer game to get the same effect. So there's that, you know, kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. They're both very important to have the details. Like, when you ask what color a rock is, it's good to have an answer. It's good to have an answer. But yet, if you don't have the answer you were thinking of right away, it leads to a running gag that lasts for years. But, and again, you don't have to know everything about everything, because you can very often just also sit back and go, yeah, there's, you know, you're in a, you know, the deck of a spaceship. And every one of us players has probably watched Star Trek, Star Wars, or, you know, other sci-fi genre items at some point in our path. And so we'll start filling in some of the details for Trav if he doesn't have them ready to go. You know, literally, yeah. Oh, hey, is there like a communications area with like all the cool buttons and things and a set of headphones? Yes? Okay, cool. We just filled that in for Trav. The other side of the coin is actually something that I'm getting into, and hopefully, you know, you can bring Trav there too, is the hybrid between the two. That kind of getting there happy place, the virtual tabletops. So, you know, Roll20,
Fancy Grounds.
Yeah, thank you. All of those. It's really amazing to be able to have like a really well done two-dimensional digital map, or even some of the ones that are the like elevations of a scene of where the fight's going to be or where the action's taking place. Now, it's still turn-based. Like, you can't hit a button and have it animate, at least not that I'm aware of yet, where you can have it like randomly moving around NPC, you know, tokens in the background. But at least it can fill in the blank with a lot of those visuals. A lot of the Patreon artists I follow are all the digital map makers for the virtual tabletops. And some of them are really wonderfully done maps, and they fill in a lot of those wonderful little random background details that you can then use as a GM or a player to go, hey, I see that in the picture over there. I would like to go check that out. And then, of course, Trav has to scramble and figure out what's down that manhole cover or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So it's that nice kind of where the two systems are starting to actually come together and create kind of a hybrid place. And I would love to see it one day where we could all just have like some very basic animations that could then fill in the blanks, the best of both worlds, but it might be a few years down the road. But yeah, visuals. Visuals are important, whether it's in your head or on the screen in front of you. It's always important.
Okay. Jonathan, how, you know, I mean, you have computer games and they do a great job of course, providing visuals and such because they are computer games. You're looking, the game lives or dies on what you see on the screen, especially these modern ones. Okay. But how, you know, how can the visuals actually be a problem?
Oh, if in a computer game, the visuals can be a problem because if they're too distracting, if it's there's two aspects of it. Number one is if the graphics are such like, I'm trying to think of an example where this has happened to me because I know it has, but I can't remember specifics, but thinking that something in the game world was important because of the way it contrasted the tone of everything else in the space, you know, like a button that was just, you know, a bright red button in a room that was all grays and browns, which in most games, you know, most video games, that would be a visual cue that is something important.
Push that button.
You should look at that. But
foreshadowing,
But there have been games where, nope, it was just somebody thought that this particular console needed a big red button.
Actually, I can honestly say I've run into that with Monster Hunter. There are spaces where I'm like, I should be able to go in there. That clearly looks like I should be able to go in there. Or that plant must be important. It's kind of in that perfect sunbeam of light. It must be lit up.
Or that cliff doesn't look too steep. I should be able to climb it, but nope, there's an invisible wall. You cannot climb it.
Yeah, you see it, but you can't react to it because the game doesn't let you do that. Okay, so that's, you know, that's true. I hadn't considered that. I'm certainly going to add that. I was thinking about the fact that, you know, in a lot of combat situations, they kind of, you know, some of these, you know, game programmers just love just go all out when that happens. And in like Fallout 76, they said, hey, let's make everybody be, well, it's everybody has the ability to get themselves a high-powered machine gun, almost like a chain gun, throwing out hundreds of rounds, and let's make every one of them explode. And let's have 10 of them, because of course everybody decided to get that, and we're now in a situation where we're trying to like kill bugs or something like that, and you're surrounded by these constant explosions all around you. I mean, you're either dazed or in a haze because you can't see anything. Your eyes are like, you know, what's going on, you know. And that might actually be realistic.
Like visual overload.
Visual overload, yeah. And that can happen in games. And, you know, I don't think anybody, you know, when they were doing the playtesting really realized how bad that was going to be. Or maybe they said, that's fine. Maybe they decided that was okay. But for me, you know, it ticks me off, you know, when they do that, you know. And so,
yeah, actually, you know what? I can honestly say, yeah, for Monster Hunter, the one thing I really, 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 really wish that they would fix or give me the option to, like, turn off is the camera shifting. Because I really hate it when I'm fighting, you know, the fire-breathing T-Rex monster, and I lose track of the thing because the camera shifted in, like, where I can see its knee, but nothing else in the scene around me. So I can't see.
That would bug the crap out of me.
It does drive me crazy. You're gonna do a little adjustment with your camera, you know, thumb button, but having to do that in the middle of a fight when you had like a rhythm going with your weapon is very annoying.
Or third person. If you're playing a game that's third person and all of a sudden the camera decides to shift off to the left or the right, and you're like, how am I supposed to aim now?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, very much so. So now I understand what you were saying about that. Yeah, that can be very distracting. Right. It does slow you down. You lose your rhythm. You lose your ability to focus on what you're supposed to be doing in that moment.
Sometimes and a minor point I'll throw in when you're done. I just wanted to add one more thing, though. Hmm. But something I discovered last year after I got my the Meta Quest was if you're playing in 3D with like virtual reality headset and you're not used to it, good visuals will make you throw up.
Oh yeah, that's why I'm not touching VR. I already know that'd be an issue for me. No, thank you.
Yeah,
yeah.
Nope. I was a younger man, I could handle it, but now it's I have to get reacquainted to virtual reality again because I have I can get maybe an hour of it before I have to go, okay, time to put this down.
When I was back in the day about 15 years ago when I was doing MMORPGs, even something as simple as first person versus third person, I have to see my avatar. I had a half-elf rogue when I was playing EverQuest back in the day. And the first person, it threw me off. I just could not deal with that. I had to have it where it's third person. So, you know, you're seeing the back side of your character and it's running across the plains to get to the next dungeon or whatever. I have to have it like that. If it's the first person where, you know, I'm looking like I am now at my living room in a video game, that just throws my stuff off big time.
Yep.
I don't know what it is. And just, yeah, I have to have it. So, and let's say that's why I have, even if I had time to play video games, first person based games where they are solely first person, I wouldn't do, because just that whole view, it just throws me off. And so, like Carrie said, with the where you're fighting and all of a sudden the camera angle, if it goes from first to third or shoots off to the left or the right, yeah, that would just make me say, I'm done with this game. And just, yeah, that would be okay. No, I just wasted my money on a game if it's doing this and there's no way to stop it. If they were trying to get some type of desired effect for the feeling of the game or whatever, and it's totally anathematical to how you play the game, yeah, it would just be no. After a while, it just, a lot of people would just say, okay, no, there's no way to change this. I'm done. Yeah, I can see where that would be a really big problem.
Well,
some
of the earlier games, they used to have this thing called Fog of War, which meant that your character could only see so far. So as a result, was that, you know, if something could be like right outside of your range of vision and could be really important, and you'd move in that direction and it would now be visible. And if you were careful, then you'd be fine. But otherwise, usually what happened then is something might trigger, you know. Now, when you're playing in some of these more modern games where it's, you know, it's first person, it's very 3D, you're looking around, you know, they don't want to just show you nothing but gray after a certain distance. So what they do is they show you generic countryside or whatever it might be, ruins or rocks or whatever like that. And you're like, oh, okay, I'm fine. And you're like running along because you want to get to your next thing. And all of a sudden, a monster stronghold literally materializes in front of you. And you're now in range of them doing something to you. And suddenly they're like, stranger. And then, you know, cannons start firing and you're like, holy crap. You turn around and run, and you're trying to run away.
Oh, no, I had... Yeah, I had that in EQ, my days of playing EQ and WoW. As I said, this was 08, 09, where you're just running across the plains or whatever after leaving Freeport, and all of a sudden somehow you're getting attacked. You're like, okay, I didn't see this coming. Yeah, I didn't see it off in the distance where I could veer off. No, all of a sudden, boom, hi, monster, and I'm doing the motion of hand in front of my face touching my nose. It's right there, and you can't get away from it. And, yeah, that stuff like that, Yeah, right. Again, that's just okay.
That's something I would chalk up to poor design, though, because
It's not poor design. It's actually, in this particular case, you know what I'm talking about is actually something they're doing to make the game more acceptable in general. You want everyone to see the environment looking so awesome and whatever. You know, you just have to learn that, hey, you know, if there's things that are just beyond your range of vision, whatever that might be, based upon the constraints of the game. You can't always go charging ahead because something might suddenly just pop out, you know?
And one of the, you know, it very much so like when exploring one of the new maps or whatever in Monster Hunter, it's very much the same thing of like, I'll go forward to this point, then I'm going to stop and pan my camera in every single direction. And I will say I have discovered that I have not lost this tendency from my younger gaming days. When I get to the edge of a cliff and I'm like trying to look over the edge of the cliff, I myself, the physical person sitting in this chair, lean forward in my chair and try and look over the edge of that cliff. And I have to remind myself that's not how
well,
it works.
Well, actually, sometimes it is. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But yeah. Yeah. But, you know.
But yeah.
Okay. So in the tabletop side, of course, you know, if someone basically didn't mention, you know, a monster stronghold that was like, you could actually see. But, you know, basically within the range of vision that you would normally have, you know, never mind the, you know, the so-called fog of war, you know, you would be very mad at them for not mentioning that. Okay. Or
I've played with a GM like that, not Trav, way back when.
Yeah. Now, what a GM sometimes does is they don't actually do a good job of describing what is ahead of you. And, you know, it can sometimes cause a situation. For example, back in my D&D days, I had a whole bunch of players, and I said, hey, out in the water of this river that you're going by, there's a giant frog. And they're all like, oh, really, a giant frog? Sounds like good eating. I'm going to go in there and get that frog. And I said, okay. So he walks in and says, all right, you know, we rolled initiative, and the frog's tongue comes out, grabs the guy, pulls him in, and he swallows him. And they're like, Bruce, yeah, how big is this giant frog? I said, it's about the size of a house. And he said, that's not just a giant frog, Bruce.
There was some confusion on the word.
Scale was a problem. It was my fault. I had failed to let them understand what it was that they were facing. So, of course, you know, they got into a huge battle, you know, trying, because there was more than one giant frog. Naturally, there were three or four giant frogs. And they all got into this big, you know, grab the person, swallow them and stuff like that, you know, where you would never expect something like that to happen, you know, in a computer role-playing game. So, you know, the GM's ability to render, you know, a scene, you know, effectively is going to be based upon their ability and any supplemental materials they have. Like, you know, if you have like a picture, you know, this part of the adventure of this particular location or stuff like that, then the players, you know, will have a lot easier time of making tactical or even strategic decisions. So,
maps are wonderful.
Go
ahead.
No, about the communication skills on the GM's part, and I think I've told Carrie this story, the British GM that mispronounced the monster term and they thought it was one thing and it's something else. Oh, yeah, so the leech is coming after you. Yeah, yeah. It was a British GM and American players. And okay, so the leech is following you out of the swamp. Okay, yeah, and we're outrunning it. And, you know, we fire back at it, and all of a sudden it throws a fireball, and they're all like, whoa, 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 what, wait, hold it, where did this come from?
How's this slimy, you know, crustacean throwing fireballs?
It took levels.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Apparently, this, I don't know if that's how they pronounce it in the UK, or just this particular game master who happened to be British mispronounced an undead wizard, lich. He pronounced the I as a double E. And it's like, yes, an undead wizard. He throws a fireball. And all of the American players look at him across it. That's a lich. That's my mistake. Loss in translation there. Yeah, we're thinking, you know, this blood-sucking giant, you know, slug-like thing. No, it's, you know, yeah. So, yeah, again, that would be the poor communication skills.
Right.
Well, I can honestly say, though, part of that, too, is there is a point at which there can be too much of that. I was in a game not too long ago where it was the GM literally would not volunteer any information about our environment at all. Everybody had to constantly ask, what is 5 feet in front of me? What is 10 feet in front of me? What is over there on the left? What is over there on the right? What do I see in the sky?
And yeah.
Perception check, you were hosed. So there is a point at which it's very good game master playing of either A, you know, describing the scene as best you can and then going, hey, does anybody want to make any perception checks for, you know, anything else? If there's like something that maybe we should be looking for, but perhaps none of us thought to look for it. And that way it can lead on to the next step without railroading and without making you do that constant. What do I perceive? What do I perceive? Make the roll. Ooh, that game was tough.
But tabletop RPGs, you can have infinite levels of detail. You can literally pick up a rock and examine it and get, you know, where before you pick up a rock and use the look command in a CRPG that says you see a rock.
Yep.
And it's quartz. Yeah. It's naturally rounded. It's a naturally rounded river stone. Oh, that means there's water nearby, or there once was.
That kind of infinite levels of detail does allow, you know, that wonderful player input of, you know, us like flipping out going, well, what's so special about this rock? Why is it being described so well? And then we spend an hour trying to figure out what's so special
about the
rock.
It's
the same effect as that big red button in the corridor. If you accidentally just put just the wrong amount of inflection on a description, it's suddenly the plot.
You've derailed your own adventure. Yes.
So yeah, there's pluses and minuses to that infinite level.
Yeah.
And there's pluses and minuses to the constrained level of detail. Yes.
I have the same problem every time they say, you're in a library. And they're all like, really? What books are on the walls? And I'm like, oh my gosh, what did they say?
Oh, yeah.
Says, you actually have this.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
In a computer game, you start clicking around, looking, seeing if it's going to tell you what's actually on the shelves. And if it doesn't happen, then you just stop. You just give up. Okay, you know, every time that you click on something and it actually gives you a response, you're like, well, this must be important. When it turns out, you know, in games like Skyrim, you know, it's really just some ancient history text that doesn't make any difference to the modern situation. Or it's somebody's like book of mushroom soups, you know.
It's the wonderful fun of the red herring for the players too.
Give
them a little fun of something to take their, you know, to distract them from this or give them an extra little something they can just do in the background for fun. Like Monster Hunter, there's just, you know, like the dialogue with the townspeople. It's like a lot of it is like horribly cheesy and has no bearing whatsoever on the overarching plot line except for like, oh no, more monsters are coming. But it's still a nice little touch that's added just to give the verisimilitude of the experience to the whole thing of just like, you know, townspeople are not just going to stand around stupidly and waving at you as you walk by. They might actually say things like, hi, come over here. Or, thank you for taking care of that thing for me. Or would you please go fetch this thing? Oh, wait, a quest.
Right.
So you very much, it encourages you, those kinds of like, fun odd details or like the books in the library encourage you to interact with the environment to see what happens.
Yeah. It's we'll talk more about that down when we get to questing. Okay. But the conclusion I have about visuals is that both of them add verisimilitude to the experience of play. And that's the big bonus that they both have, which is something that, you know, and while the computer game usually is far more immediate, you know, what you see, Okay, the fact that a GM on a tabletop can actually add infinite levels of detail is where their strength is. So it's, you know, there's lots of money being spent, so you can get a lot more artwork and a lot more kind of stuff like that in a computer game than you do in a role-playing game, unless it's very, very well funded. Okay, but the GM is usually able to, you know, fill in the blanks in a way that makes people, you know, and the fact that people playing tabletop RPGs know they have to fill in the blanks in their brains, so they're more willing to do so. So that's, you know, I think they're both in a way equal but different, you know, in this aspect. Okay, yeah. So but you mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to follow up on, which was accessibility. How, you know, Trav, how does accessibility differ between computer games and tabletop RPGs?
Well, with a computer RPG, that computer can run pretty much continuously and just flip it on anytime, day or night, when you got the time. Hey, I want to, you know, I got a couple hours. Let's go back to BG3 and I can be there in the Underdark and deal with the flares and all that. Yeah, I want to get through this maze. And yeah, you can do that at your whim. As long as the computer's working, go to it. And the computer will do all the heavy lifting and you're just navigating through. And yeah, you can just sit there, whether it's 3 a.m. or noon on a Saturday, and just go to it. Yeah. And for if you want to sit there and just, okay, 15 minutes, I'll try to dope this out, I'm almost done. Or if you want to just devote, I have a free afternoon, I've got 5 hours, I can do this, let's go. Yeah, that's the beauty about computer role-playing games. That when I did play them, if I had the free block of time, sure, go to it.
So how is it for tabletops, Carrie?
Yeah.
Carrie?
Oh, it was directly at me. I'm so sorry. I mean, literally, it is the opposite. We are human beings. We need to eat. We need to sleep. Maybe. Occasionally. So, and there's always the infinite issue of gathering a group of people together, agreeing to one time, and everybody as adults coordinating their schedules magically to always be there that night and time or day and time, what have you. So literally as living, breathing human beings, the GM and the players can't always make the game happen. It has to be a group effort, at least two, three people minimum, preferably more. But on the other hand, it is a social actual event. So, like, beyond the game itself, there, you know, if it's lucky enough to be in person, you know, there's the bringing of the snacks, the feeding of the food, the trading of the stories before and after the game, just the funny faces and jokes across the room, whatever it may be. So while it's very limited time, relatively speaking, and availability for a tabletop, it does have that social gathering aspect to it that you can't get pretty much any other way. I mean, yes, online gaming, yes, but people are still hardwired for face-to-face communication.
We are social creatures by nature. Our very
even the most introverted of us need at least a little humanity every now and again, just a little.
Yeah.
That we choose. Yeah. But I mean, the downside to that is that computer RPGs don't necessarily have the means or built-in ability to cater to people who are unable to interface with the game by its intended things. So I don't believe there are many, you know, computer games that have support for the visually impaired. Like, there would have to be very specific things done for that, or for, you know, physically impaired. So that is the one thing that tabletop RPGs can still do very much better, is you can make accommodations for somebody who can't see.
Or can't hear.
Or can't hear. And I'm just wondering now, I'm like, I might have to go look and see if there are Braille versions of, like, you know, the core rule books and so forth. Now I'm curious. I have to find out.
Now, one thing that the better computer games have done is that they now at least have color palettes that are directed toward people who have different kinds of color blindness.
Oh, okay, that's really cool.
And that took a that took a long time for people to be able to, you know, to say, hey, that's really important. And it was actually driven by the business software, because in a business software, if you're using green and blue and red indicators for, you know, a good thing and a bad thing, and somebody can't read that because their vision, you know, they have color blindness, they can make some really bad decisions that are really wide reaching. So that's one reason why a lot of effort's been put into that, and games finally started waking up and saying, you know, we really ought to give the opportunity to, you know, make our orcs, you know, or our goblins brown instead of green, because for some reason they're invisible for some of our players.
I mean, I'm gonna interject a little thought. I will say the one thing that, you know, a lot of the games do is there are auditory clues as well as visual clues when something is appearing in the scene. You know, when a monster shows up, or this particular enemy, or this particular, you know, ally. So that definitely might actually have been caused a little bit by that, by needing to have a secondary indicator for, you know, character on scene.
You know, push the red button or the green button.
Yeah, push the big shiny candy like red button.
And you know, to you, they're all the same color. They're, you know, if they have exactly the same brightness or shade, then, you know, you can't tell the difference between the two buttons. Because I know people that, you know, when they're driving, you know, they can't tell the, you know, if they take the red and green, you know, traffic lights and they put them sideways, they can't tell which one is lit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be an issue.
Yeah.
So, this has been in the past a problem for computers, but they picked up on that a little bit more. But, you know, when you have a bunch of players sitting around a table, usually people are willing to admit to this, and the GM can adjust to this, which makes that aspect of it, you know, a strength that the computer RPGs are catching up in now. It's not what it was, but it still has some limitations in that regard. We won't even talk about things like strobing, yeah, which can be a real problem for some people with, you know, and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'd love to continue with this, but unfortunately, we have run out of time for this session. We will have to come back and do more about the difference, the similarities and differences between computer RPGs and table RPGs. But you'll have to wait until next week. So until then.
This is Bruce Sheffer saying, there are a million worlds out there, so go explore them.
And this is Trav. There's a reason why it's called gaming. It's for having fun.
Gaming on the Frontier podcast is wholly owned by its hosts. It is released under the Creative Commons 3.0 license. No commercial reproduction and any use of any element of the podcast must be attributed to the Gaming on the Frontier podcast.
Hi, this is Trav from the Travcast. Listen to me Tuesday nights, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern on listen.dementiaradio.org/8027.